For the past couple of hundred years, critical scholarship has really done a job on the book of Acts. And they have particularly, as a result of the different types of approaches that are involved in the studies of particularly what is known as higher criticisms, there has been this question that has been created about the historical reliability that is actually found within the book of Acts. And I begin my outline with a couple of quotes that I think illustrates this point. One from a conservative scholar by the name of Richard Longnecker, who wrote, "Indeed, if we did not have Acts, or if Acts were proved historically unreliable, we would know nothing of the earliest days of the Christian movement except for bits of data gathered from the letters of Paul or inferred by looking back from later developments. To attempt a study of early Christianity apart from Acts, therefore, is to proceed mainly ignotum per ignotius, which simply means the unknown explained by the still more unknown." And he goes on to say, "For information about the early church gained from Paul's letters often lack in historical context." And then Leander Keck, who is on the liberal side of this, in his book, Paul and His Letters, he said, "The letters from the man, or from Paul, often do not support the report about him in Acts. Because the Paul of Acts is the Paul most people know best, one should guard against assimilating the Paul of the letters to the Paul of Acts." And again, I think what it does is it illustrates what has become a problem, particularly among critical scholarship, about the historical reliability that has been questioned for at least the past couple of hundred years. And really what it boils down to is that Luke, as he describes Paul and the events that surround his actions within the book of Acts, is said to differ significantly from Paul himself and the way Paul depicts himself in the letters that he has written. In other words, what it boils down to is that Paul and the contents of the letters that he wrote simply do not and cannot harmonize with the content that is found within the book of Acts that is indeed written by Luke. And as, again, Longnecker points out, the primary argument against the historicity of Acts is that it completely breaks down the moral character of the Apostle Paul, presenting him as quite a different person than he appears in his own letters. Okay, now, I'm here to resolve this. And I will tell you, when Kevin gave me the task, Sid last night was talking about how that he would rather not had the introduction. I would have rather had anything but this particular study. And the reason for it is because nothing that I'm going to say to you is in concrete. It is purely speculative. But it is things that I think we can make some kind of at least an intelligent, intuitive decision on based upon evidences that are contained within the scriptures as well as from secular historians as well. Now, I'm going to be pretty much following my outline. I'm not going to be following all of it, obviously, because there's just not enough time, but there are parts of it that I will be following quite closely. I do not have a PowerPoint. I was telling Kevin, I tried to prepare something for it, and this just didn't seem to fit anything. I was just basically putting in PowerPoint what is in the outline, and so I figured you can look at the outline as easy as you can look at PowerPoint. And so that's what I'm going to just simply do, is kind of just basically go along with the outline, and I will tell you the different pages that I will be going to if you are following along with that outline. Now, I do want to note with you on the first page, I point out that I am not going to be covering the chronology of all 21 letters of the New Testament. In fact, in this discussion, I'm not going to be covering any of it with the exception of the book of Galatians. And the reason for that is, again, because of the time element. And I think that people are more interested, at least this particular audience, would be more interested in what are considered to be the historical anomalies between the book of Acts and Paul's writings, as opposed to just when were the letters written and at what point and things of that nature. So even in the outline, there's really only seven letters that I address. I kind of briefly talk about the prison epistles, but those don't affect the history of the book of Acts because they are believed to have been written after the historical narrative of Acts had come to a close. Now, I will point out to you that, as I point out in the bottom part of this, that any chronology that you can come up with is only going to be speculative. And the reason for that is because we just don't have enough information in the Bible as well as in secular history. But one thing that we do have are a lot of things in which the secular historical records and then the historical narrative that you find in the book of Acts have a tendency to overlap in certain places. And I think it was Sid who mentioned the one particularly historical marker, which is the what has been called the Gallio inscription or the Delphi inscription, which is quite significant because it does provide a marker by which you can go backwards and forwards in Paul's career to be able to then begin to figure out, at least in some kind of a reasonable way, just exactly when the letters were written and where they were also written from. Now, what I'm going to be doing primarily is I do want to discuss the chronology of the book of Galatians because it is relevant to what we're going to be talking about. But then what I want to do is to proceed into these problems, what are the alleged discrepancies, and I want to look at, as time permits, I want to look at three categories of those that I have found, one dealing with the historical, one dealing with theological. And then there is one that just simply is, it's one that is stuck out like a sore thumb in the minds of a lot of people, and that is how Luke portrays Paul in the book of Acts versus the way Paul portrays himself in his letters. And there's believed by many historians, particularly liberal historians, to be all kinds of discrepancy there. So I first want to begin, though, on page 5 of this outline, by talking about a little bit about the chronology of the book of Galatians, again, because it is something that is critical to how we understand a lot of the other things that are characteristic of the way Luke records his history and the way Paul records what little history he does in his letters. Of all of the letters that Paul has written that fall within the historical narrative, the book of Galatians is probably the most problematic. And it's problematic for two reasons. One is because of the historical content that Paul does, in fact, allude to or talk about within the book of Galatians that does not seem to fit within the Acts narrative. And I'll have more to say about that in a minute. But it's also problematic because we don't know for certain, nor can we know for certain, to whom this book was written. We cannot know for certain when it was written, and we cannot know for certain from where it is written. And that will have an impact upon how we understand a lot of the history of Paul himself that he was talking about in the book of Galatians and then comparing that with what Luke says about Paul in the book of Acts. Determining when Galatians was written is going to be influenced particularly by what a person comes to believe about to whom this particular letter was written. And so there are two primary views. One is what is called the Northern Galatian view, which is the view that Paul wrote to Christians making up local churches in what is identified as the old northern ethnic region known as Galatia. And this view holds to the fact that Paul entered into this particular area on his second evangelistic trip, which is a history that Luke allegedly alludes to, but he doesn't go into any kind of detail about it. And over in Acts 16, verse 6 is where this is found, where it says, "And they went through the region of Phrygia and Galatia, having been forbidden by the Holy Spirit to speak the words in Asia." Now, you take that, and then you compare that with what you find over in Acts, the 18th chapter, in verse 23, where here we are finding Paul beginning his third evangelistic trip, and it is indicated that he revisits this section, as it says there in this 23rd verse, "After spending some time there, he departed and went from one place to the next through the region of Galatia and Phrygia, strengthening all the disciples." Now, the reason why it is that some have come to the conclusion that this is the northern area of Galatia is because this is it can be identified as an ethnic region, what were known as Galatians. The southern area of Galatia was not populated by people of that particular ethnicity. Now, there were some who lived there, but the primary ethnic group lived up in the north. And the reason why they have come to the conclusion that it is referring to this ethnic group is because of Phrygia. because Phrygia was, in fact, an area, and you can read about this, that was constantly changing. It never, I mean, you can find on a map, you can find where it was located there within the region of Turkey or Asia Minor. You can see where it's kind of allocated by a border. But from what I understand, those borders were constantly changing. And the reason for it is because this ethnic group was constantly moving. And so as a result, there was no real place that you could call Phrygia. And so they allocated the name not to an area particularly as much as it was to an ethnic group. And so wherever the Phrygians were, that's where Phrygia was. And so what you see is these guys then saying, well, because Phrygia was referring to an ethnic group, Galatia must be referring to an ethnic group too as well. So that's how they have concluded that Paul went into this northern region of Galatia, and that's who this letter is actually written to based upon that particular understanding. Now, what this does is it assumes then that this letter would have been written subsequent to the events that are found in Acts 18, verse 23, which therefore would associate it with a late date, usually having believed to have been written from the city of Ephesus during Paul's lengthy stay there, which is recorded in Acts 19, or perhaps after he left Ephesus, and it says he went into the regions of Macedonia over in Acts chapter 20 and verse 1, he could have written it at that particular point in time too as well. So that's one view. That's the northern view. Now the southern view is the second one, and this is where Paul wrote to Christians making up the local churches in the southern region of what was known as the larger Roman province known as Galatia. And this view holds that the churches that Paul established in Galatia during his first evangelistic trip, which would consist of Antioch of Pisidia, of Iconium, of Lystra, and Derbe, these are the churches that Paul is addressing. These are the churches that he revisited during his second and third evangelistic trips that Luke does, in fact, record. And if this is the correct setting, then Galatians could have been written either during between Paul's first and second trips. It could have been written on his second trip, or it could have even been written on his third trip, therefore making the time in question very broad, anywhere from 48 AD to 56 AD. And if, in fact, you take the early date, which is what I will be taking, then this was probably the first letter that the Apostle Paul actually wrote. Now, the broad period of time that has been made by this southern Galatian view can become a little bit more narrow based upon the different positions that relate itself to the Jerusalem Council, which is found over there in Acts chapter 15. There are some who are a minority, and I will tell you that I have come to this conclusion myself. I think it's a very reasonable conclusion. But there are some, and albeit it is a minority of people, who take the view that Galatians was probably written before the Jerusalem Council, probably while Paul was in Antioch, in between his first and his second trips, which is talked about in Acts the 14th chapter, where he stayed there for a lengthy period of time before he took off, after the Jerusalem Council took off on his second evangelistic trip. And if, in fact, that's the case, this would date it somewhere between the dates of 48 and 49 A.D. Now, most take the view, and I don't know what view you all hold to, I'm sure that'll be discussed, but most take the view that Galatians was probably written after the Jerusalem Council, perhaps while Paul was in Corinth, as it is recorded in Acts 18, or maybe he could have written it in Antioch during the period between Acts 18, 22, or this period of time in which it talks about him going up to the church, then going down to the church at Antioch, and then he takes off on his third evangelistic trip. So it could very well be that he wrote it at that time, if in fact you take the view that it was written after the Jerusalem Council. It could have been written even during his lengthy stay that he had in the city of Ephesus, and therefore it could date it anywhere from 51 to 56 A.D. Now again, as I point out in my outline and as I've already said, I am inclined now to take this minority view that the book of Galatians was probably written before the Jerusalem Council and probably from Antioch around the years A.D. 48 to 49, and I'll discuss my reasons for coming to that conclusion a little bit later, and then you'll be able to also address that during the Q&A session. Okay, so basically what this all comes down to is what Luke Johnson wrote when he said that trying to assign a date to the writing of Galatians and then some of these other epistles that Paul wrote, he said informed guesses are possible, but all they remain are guesses. And I think that's the best way to be able to assess this particular problem that we're dealing with. Okay, now with that in mind, I'm going to go on to page 9 now. And I want to begin to address some of these, what are the apparent problems and discrepancies in the book of Acts and in the Pauline epistles. Now, really, this is the issue. The historicity of the book of Acts is something that is more questioned in light of Paul than anything else. And as Longnecker pointed out, it is really the issue of Paul. And so you have to struggle with these things, and there are some dilemmas that are there. Kevin made it quite clear that there are some problematic areas, but are they insurmountable? I don't believe any of them are insurmountable. I don't know if I have the answers to all of them. I'm not sure I have answers to any of them. But I do believe that there are answers that are very logical, very reasonable, and we don't have to resort to some kind of a skeptic attitude towards Luke and his ability to record history. There are many of these problems. When I was doing the research that I did on this, I couldn't believe how many address. Some of them are just so trivial and minor. It's just people who are looking for things to pick on. But then there are some things that are actual, some things that are legitimate. And these are the things that I tried to utilize in the research in order to be able to illustrate these points. So I state the problem, and the problem is this. The book of Acts contains the only historical narrative account of Paul's ministry, but it is what is identified as a secondhand source. In other words, it was written by Luke as he is looking back on Paul's ministry, and it is not written by Paul himself. And so what Luke writes about Paul's ministry is not contemporary to the events that he records. In other words, he is writing those events later than after they have taken place. That's what history is. Acts, I think Sid pointed out, is believed to have been written sometime, at least the most conservative dating would have been around sometime around 64 AD. Well, that's what he is writing about obviously happened long after Paul had written many of the letters that he had written by that time. But the letters of Paul, on the other hand, are what are called firsthand. In other words, they are the primary sources in looking at the history of his ministry. Paul wrote his own letters, or I think as we understand, he dictated some of those letters, but Paul is the one who is the source of it. Actually, the Holy Spirit would be. But attributing it from a historian's perspective, it would be Paul who would be the source. And within many of these letters are references to historical events that obviously he was contemporary with. He did these things. And so therefore, to an historian, Paul's letters would have greater value as historical sources than the book of Acts would. And the problem is that the history that Paul records in his letters, in the history that Luke records in Acts, appear to differ or disagree at some very significant points, therefore bringing into question the historical reliability of the Acts narrative itself. And I have four examples of this that I want to suggest to you that are the four most common ones that I found. The first one relates itself to Paul's visits to Jerusalem. According to the Acts account, after Paul's conversion to Christianity, he visited Jerusalem at least four times and probably five times. But according to Paul's own account in his letters, and particularly in the book of Galatians, he only visited Jerusalem three times, presenting, therefore, what appears to be an historical discrepancy. Two of the times in the book of Galatians, he refers to two times he visited. Once, he refers to a visit out of the book of Romans. And so I've kind of have listed here what would be kind of like a chronological approach to all of this. You have in the Acts account, in Acts chapter 9, the first visit that Paul made after his conversion. And then in Acts chapter 11, there would be he and Barnabas who went to Jerusalem with this benevolent relief that had been sent by the church at Antioch, which would be his second visit to Jerusalem. In Acts chapter 15, when he goes to Jerusalem for what is known as this Jerusalem Council. And in Acts 18, chapter 22, returning from his second evangelistic journey, before he goes up to Antioch, which would be considered his fourth visit, some would take the position that the church he actually visited would be the church at Caesarea, not the church at Jerusalem. And I would refer you to the Net Bible. If you have the Net Bible, they actually put the church at Jerusalem in the text, even though that's an addition. But they do have a note, a translator note, that is in there why they do that, and they justify it. And I think it's a very reasonable justification. I have come to the conclusion that this was, in fact, he went to Caesarea, then he went to Jerusalem, and then he went down to Antioch. Then the fifth visit then would have been after his returning from his third evangelistic journey, which led to his arrest. Okay, now, Paul's account in his letters, he talks about 3 years after his conversion, he made this brief visit to Jerusalem, visiting Peter and James, in Galatians chapter 1, verse 18. Then in Galatians 2, he talks about how that after 14 years, which is most likely 14 years after his conversion, he went to Jerusalem again in the company of Barnabas and Titus. And then in Romans chapter 15 is this third visit, which was a planned visit to Jerusalem to bring a collection from the Gentile churches to the church in Jerusalem. So the question is then, is there a conflict between the Acts account and between Paul's account? Well, it's recognized by just about everyone, both liberal as well as conservative scholars, that the Acts account of Paul's first visit to Jerusalem corresponds with Paul's own account of his first visit to Jerusalem. In other words, Galatians 1:18 equals Acts chapter 9, verses 20 through 26. It's also recognized that Paul's account of his planned visit to Jerusalem, that is his last visit, is also, in fact, historically verified by the Acts account. In other words, what Paul spoke about in Romans chapter 15 is historically identified in what Luke records in Acts chapter 21. So there's no problem with these two. The first one and the last one, there's not a problem with. The conflict comes, and what appears to be the discrepancy that is found in the book of Acts is the fact that it disagrees with Paul's second visit to Jerusalem and Paul's own account of his second visit to the city of Jerusalem. Now, it's believed by the majority that Paul's account of his second visit, Galatians 2, corresponds to the Acts account of Paul's third visit of the Jerusalem Council, which is recorded in Acts chapter 15. And so the question is asked, why would Paul not mention the second visit that is mentioned in the Acts account? And because he doesn't, it is then assumed that the Acts account is something that is historically unreliable. It can't be trusted. Now, some have tried to get around the weight of this apparent discrepancy by arguing that Paul most likely didn't refer to the second visit that is spoken of in Acts 11 because it served him no real purpose in addressing what he did in the book of Galatians. And therefore, he just didn't refer to it or didn't feel like he needed to refer to it, and therefore because he didn't refer to it or didn't mention it doesn't really mean it didn't happen. Well, that's reasonable. I think that is indeed a reasonable approach. I don't think it's the best, and I don't think, at least for my thinking, and particularly in reading all of this stuff, it is not, at least for me, it was not satisfactory. And so I began to do a little bit more research in all of this. And one of the things that has been brought up by the liberal scholars is the fact that one of Paul's main points in Galatians is that his message, allegedly, did not come from men. It didn't come from even other apostles, but it came from God, that it was a divine source of revelation that he speaks about in Galatians chapter 1 in verses 11 through 17. Now, in my mind, since in fact this is what he was seeking to establish, that is that he did not get his revelation from anybody but God, then the amount of times he visited Jerusalem, where the apostles were, would have been important to his argument. Because if, in fact, it would be argued that Paul had gone to Jerusalem a whole lot or very little would depend a great deal upon whether or not they would come to the conclusion that Paul had gotten this by revelation or did he get it from these other men who he spent a great deal of time around. So how many times he had been to Jerusalem was something that was very critical to his argument. And that being the case, he would not be disingenuous or not think that it wouldn't be necessary to tell you all of the times that he had been to Jerusalem, at least up to the point of time in which he wrote the Galatian letter. So I believe that there is a better way to address this chronological problem and to resolve this, apparent discrepancy. And what I have come to conclude is that the second visit that Paul speaks of in Galatians 2 is not the third visit that Paul speaks of in Acts chapter Luke speaks of in Acts chapter 15. In fact, what I have come to conclude is that the second visit that Paul speaks about in Galatians 2 is the second visit that Luke records in Acts chapter 11. And I'll be able to show you that, I think, in a little bit more. Really, what this boils down to is the fact that it takes into consideration in this Jerusalem council. And that's where this apparent problem really gets kind of sticky. And so I turn our attention to this Jerusalem council for at least a historical perspective on this. The Jerusalem council creates problems from a historical perspective as well as a theological perspective, which I'll address some of that in a minute. But the historical problem centers in two questions. First of all, when did the Jerusalem Council happen, as particularly as it relates to the writing of the book of Galatians? And then the second thing is, did it happen at all? In other words, is this something that really took place, or is it something that Luke just kind of added to his account because he was writing for literary, theological purposes and he had an agenda, and so he created this in order to be able to prove his points? Well, that point, I address that in the outline. I don't really think that it's something that is that critical that I go over with all of you about. If you want to ask some questions about it, that'll be fine. But to me, it seems like what the real problem is when did it happen? That's the issue. That's the question that it seems we need to address. Okay. Did the Jerusalem Council take place after Paul wrote Galatians, or did it take place before Paul wrote Galatians? In other words, did Paul write the book of Galatians before the Jerusalem Council, or did he write it after the Jerusalem Council? Okay, now let's go back over this historical issue. Acts records probably five visits that Paul made to Jerusalem, but Paul only records two in the book of Galatians. It is this second visit that Paul recounts in Galatians chapter 2 which lends itself to this apparent historical discrepancy within the book of Acts. And so the question is the second visit that Paul speaks of in Galatians 2 the third visit recorded in Acts 15, or is it in fact the second visit that Luke records in Acts chapter 11? I will tell you that both positions have their strengths and both positions have their weaknesses. But I believe that the one position that presents the least amount of difficulty, as well as, in my mind, providing the most satisfactory explanation of the Acts account of Paul's travels, is equating Paul's account of his second visit in Jerusalem with the Acts account of Paul's second visit, Luke's account, or the Acts account of Paul's second visit in Jerusalem. In other words, Galatians 2 equals Acts 11, not Acts 15. And what this does then is it removes any kind of an apparent historical discrepancy between Acts and Galatians. And I quite frankly believe that if for no other reason, what this does is it provides a powerful explanation as to the criticism as to why it is that Paul did not use the letter resulting from this council to argue his point in the Galatian letter. Why wouldn't he? He doesn't even mention the Jerusalem council and the conclusion that they had come to in the book of Galatians. It would have been easy for him to do so. I believe it would have been extremely helpful for him to do so because it provided an authoritative argument for him to be able to defend his position against the Jewish legalizers. So why didn't he use the Jerusalem Council, that is, this letter that was produced through the Jerusalem Council in the Galatian letter? My answer is because most likely it hadn't happened yet. And based on this, therefore, I offer what is a suggested chronology of Paul's early ministry. Barnabas locates Paul in Tarsus. He brings him back to Antioch, where they worked with the church there, a church that was made up primarily of Gentiles, as is revealed in Acts chapter 11. Now, while they were there, Agabus comes to Antioch with a revelation from the Spirit that there is this great famine that is going to occur, which motivated the Christians at Antioch to send benevolent relief to their Jewish brethren in Jerusalem and in Judea, as is indicated there in the latter part of Acts chapter 11. And because of this revelation, Paul and Barnabas, and apparently, if what I'm saying is correct, apparently Titus also went to Jerusalem with this relief. And while they were there, Paul related the message that he had been preaching among the Gentiles to James and to Peter and to John, who had no issues with Paul's teaching, and therefore extended to him this right hand of fellowship that Paul speaks about in Galatians 2, verses 1 through 10. And here's a point that I hadn't really noticed before until I began to study this. The Galatians 2, verse 2, says that Paul went up to Jerusalem. The New King James Version says by revelation. The English Standard Version and the New American Standard Bible says that Paul went up to Jerusalem because of a revelation. And in the New International Version, it translates it, he went up in response to a revelation. What this does, it seems to me, is it fits better the historical events that took place in Acts chapter 11 than it does anything else. Because what you see is that a revelation had been given to Agabus by the Spirit about this famine that was going to take place, and based upon that revelation, the decision was made to go to the city of Jerusalem with this benevolent gift that they were going to be giving to their brethren there. So Paul goes up to, Jerusalem because of a revelation. And that's exactly what he says in Galatians chapter 2, verse 2. It appears then that if that's the case, that this brief meeting resolved the issue of whether or not Gentiles could be and should be included in the family of God. But it did not resolve what was really the bigger issue. And the bigger issue is, on what basis can Gentiles be entered or be declared as part of the family of God? In other words, how do they enter into this relationship of being a part of the family of God? That is an issue that began to fester. There was no question that Gentiles can be a part of the family of God. That was indicated with Cornelius. But the question is, upon what basis can they become children of God? They hadn't addressed that yet. So this now becomes an issue that begins to fester, and it is eventually going to have to be addressed. Paul and his company then returned to Antioch from Jerusalem, and eventually they were sent out on their first evangelistic trip. And a large portion of that trip consisted of traveling through southern Galatia, establishing these churches there in Iconium and Lystra and Derbe and those places. And then they returned to Antioch, having completed their first trip. And when they came back to Antioch, it says that they remained there a long time. That's all it says. It doesn't tell us how long a time it was, but apparently it was a long time. And during this time, it becomes apparent that the issue that had been festering had finally now come to a head. And that is the issue, upon what basis can Gentiles enter the family of God? And so it became a problem, starting in Antioch, spreading to Jerusalem, and it appears to have spread as far as Galatia from very early on. That this was a problem in Antioch is also made evident by the fact that Peter, at some point, he comes to the city of Antioch, and although initially he had table fellowship with the Gentiles, he withdrew that fellowship when some Jewish brothers from Jerusalem came along, and they started causing problems, which then forced Paul to get into this dispute. And in fact, if you'll look at this passage in Acts the 15th chapter, which is about them coming to Jerusalem, why it even happened, It says, but some men came down from Judea. Now, they've already been in Antioch for a long period of time. That's all we know. They've been there a long period of time. As it says in verse 28 of chapter 14, they remained no little time with the disciples. But some men came down from Judea and were teaching the brothers, unless you are circumcised according to the custom of Moses, you cannot be saved. Well, I would submit to you that what that has reference to is what I think it could be tied in with, at least, is what Paul spoke about over in the Galatian letter, in Galatians chapter 2, beginning there in the 11th verse, where he says, but when Cephas came to Antioch, I opposed him to his face because he stood condemned. For before certain men came from James, came from Jerusalem, came from Judea, he was eating with Gentiles. But when they came, he drew back and separated himself, fearing the circumcision party. And thus the problem develops. And Peter is a critical part of this. So now it had clearly become a problem among the brethren in Antioch, among the brethren in Jerusalem, and now it appears it had spread all the way to Galatia. It's a problem. And because it had become such a major issue, particularly due to Peter's influence in the city of Antioch, this issue was then taken to Jerusalem, and it was taken for discussion and consultation, resulting then in what was this Spirit-led decision that the Gentiles do not have to become Jews to be a part of the family of God, but that they should respect Jewish culture and Jewish ways. Now again, going back to this earlier point, assuming that this letter was written to the southern churches in the Roman province of Galatia, and assuming that it was written before the Jerusalem Council for reasons that I've already stated, this would make Paul's earliest letter, for the purpose of trying to resolve what had become an extremely critical issue. So it's a major problem. And now they're going to Jerusalem to figure it out. And I like the remark that F.F. Bruce noted, who does, by the way, take this early position, that is, that Galatians 2 equals Acts 11. He said that with respect to Peter and the precarious position he found himself in, because he was partially, in fact, he was quite responsible for the magnitude of this controversy, he said, Peter must have welcomed the resolution of this dilemma. Now, it's granted that this is only one view that can be taken. And when you stand up, when I stand up here to defend, I was telling my wife, I said, it's like a doctoral dissertation, you know, you got to give it and then everybody's going to drill you, and you have to defend what you've just said. Well, I don't really feel like I have to defend this. All I'm trying to do is point out that this is one way you can view this. There are other views, there are other positions that can be taken, but my point is, and this is the point that I'm trying to prove, that it is not, that the discrepancy is an apparent discrepancy. There are ways to explain it. Now, this may not be the way you explain it, but this is an explanation. And all I'm supposed to do is to present alternatives to the position that the book of Acts is something that is historically unreliable. So I think in that respect, I've done my job. Okay, the second thing I want to talk about is the resurrection appearances of Paul. And we're probably not even going to get into the theological and the this other aspect of Paul, how he views himself versus Luke. But these historical ones, though, I think are important. With respect to the resurrection appearances of Paul, it's argued that in Paul's letters, he speaks of his experience of the resurrection as an objective reality. In other words, that he actually saw Jesus. He says that over in 1 Corinthians, the 15th chapter, where in verses 3 through 8, particularly in verse 8, he says, last of all, as to one untimely born, he appeared to me also. But in the Acts account, the argument is that Luke, in recording what Paul said, Luke characterizes what Paul experienced not as an actual appearance or a literal seeing of Jesus, as much as it was that he had a vision. And in fact, that's what it says in Acts, the 26th chapter, in verse 19, as Luke puts these words into Paul's mouth, where he says, therefore, O King Agrippa, I was not obedient to the heavenly vision. And so it is argued that in this conversion account that is given here in Acts chapter 26, that what Paul is actually speaking about, or what Luke is saying that Paul experienced, was nothing more than a vision or some kind of a mystical experience. And it's further argued that according to the Acts account, particularly as it's found in the ninth chapter of Acts, that the point of what Paul was doing is to emphasize something that he heard, not necessarily something that he saw. It's argued that according to the Acts account, Paul saw a brilliant light, but he didn't see a bodily resurrected Jesus. Instead, Luke has Paul declaring that he had an experience of this vision, which is then defined to mean this mystical inward experience, which is then described as what Luke understood to have happened to Paul, that Paul didn't really see Jesus, he just had a vision of Jesus. Okay, now what I found interesting is this word vision. From the Theological Dictionary of the New Testament, it's the word optasia, which carries with it the objective reality of the thing that is seen. In other words, this was not some kind of a mystical inward experience that Paul had, but it was in fact an objective reality. Jesus appeared to Paul. And even Luke records this. He records this event in ways in which it depicts an appearance. He records this event, first of all, as him seeing a brilliant light. But what it suggests is not so much that Paul didn't see Jesus, it suggests Jesus in his glorified state. And it's pretty much like at the Mount of Transfiguration when he changed. And the way the English Standard Version says in Luke 9, his clothes were dazzling white. Matthew's account says his face shone like the sun and his clothes were white as light. Now the way Luke characterizes what Paul saw in the speech that he records Paul to have made in Acts 26, makes it clear that Luke recognized his experience as, in fact, a real external event and not some kind of a mystical inward experience. In fact, in this, he records Paul saying, not only did I see this light, but others saw the light and they reacted to it. And it's clear from this that it was an external event that everyone experienced, although Luke goes on to show that Paul's the only one who really understood what it was all about. And it's also clear throughout the Acts narrative that Luke recognized that what Paul experienced was more than just an internal, mystical experience, but was indeed an actual appearance of Jesus to Paul. And so you can look like in Acts chapter 9, verse 17, I have the verses down there, it uses the word appeared, the same word Paul uses in 1 Corinthians 15. So Luke is saying that Paul actually saw what Paul said he actually saw, and that is Jesus. Now, this next one, I'm going to just skip that one about the collection. That one was so simple that, I mean, you don't even have to really do a lot of research to figure that one out. But I do want to get into this theological problem, and there are a couple of those, and I know I'm not going to have enough time to deal with them all, but there's one in particular that was brought up yesterday when Andrew was doing his talk. First of all, let me state what the problem is, and this is true in all of these theological points. But what is argued is that through the actions and the speeches of Paul, as they're reported in the book of Acts, Luke is not actually revealing what Paul himself believed as much as what Luke is doing is telling through the voice and the actions of Paul what he believed. In other words, it's believed by liberal scholars that Luke, in the book of Acts, is not describing Paul's theology, he is describing his own theology. And he's doing it through the words and the actions of Paul, as it is believed he's also doing this through Peter and Stephen and others. And so when you compare the theology that is attributed to Paul, as revealed in the book of Acts, with respect to Paul's theology that is revealed in his own writings, there's this discrepancy. And again, where do we go to first to figure out what Paul's theology was? To Luke's record of it or to Paul's own account? So Paul's account becomes firsthand, Luke's account becomes secondhand, and it is believed that there is a discrepancy. And so we come now to the issue of Jewish vows and customs, for instance. And it's been observed that throughout Paul's letters, he makes a passionate argument that the Jewish-held belief that for a Gentile to be saved and to be a part of God's people, one had to be circumcised and keep the law of Moses, which was a belief that many Jewish Christians held to. Paul said that is not true, and I will not tolerate it. He made it clear that it is a righteousness of God manifested apart from the law. He made it clear of not having a righteousness of my own that comes from the law, but that comes through faith in Christ Jesus. And the whole book of Galatians is written for that purpose. But in the Acts narrative, Paul is now seen as one who participates in Jewish practices and customs in accordance with the law, lending his support to the continual practice of observing the law, which appears to be in conflict with its theology that is found in his own letters. And so you see in the Acts account, Paul circumcises Timothy. Paul takes this vow at Cenchrea. To complete the vow, he cuts his hair. Whether that's Nazarite or not, no one knows. But it's Jewish, whatever it is. The observance of a vow in which he joined these four Jewish Christians in this lengthy temple ritual that's recorded in Acts 21. And so it appears from this that either the Acts account of Paul reveals that he contradicted his own theology, that he is wrong, or else Luke is reporting events that didn't really happen. Well, I think that this can best be stated by what Jacob Gervell, and that is a book that became a treasure trove for me. If you don't have that book, it's an old book, but it is well worth what you could spend on it. In his book, The Unknown Paul, he said, "The Christian Paul lives as a practicing Jew." The fact is, Paul never objected to Jewish practices per se that were part of the law. And in fact, he continued in them himself as well as encouraging other Jewish Christians to continue in them. He said, "If you were called when you were circumcised, do not become uncircumcised." What Paul objected to was the teaching that this practice, this observance of the law, was what made one a part of the family of God, is what saved them, is what identified them as part of the family of God. And so when Judaizers appeared on the scene teaching and requiring that the Gentiles had to be circumcised and observe the law of Moses, in other words, they had to become Jewish in order to become a part of the family of God, Paul resisted this, as seen in the Galatian letter. These Jewish Christians were still Jews. They carried a national heritage, a culture, and traditions, and all of these kinds of things. And so you see what Richard Longnecker wrote when he said, "Thus, while he strongly denounced those who asserted that the law was necessary for righteousness and or fellowship within the church, he also tolerated in Christian love those who were true believers, yet who viewed the law as necessary form of religious expression and manner of life for all with a Jewish background." And so what I believe this relates then to, it goes back to Christian liberty. And what we are seeing demonstrated in Paul and the way he practiced things, particularly about the Jewish ways, is Christian liberty. It's not that he was wrong. Now, they may have characterized him as being wrong. They may have characterized him as being inconsistent. But Paul viewed himself as exercising liberty and allowing others to use liberty. And I think that's the critical aspect of all of this. He was not inconsistent in his theology. He firmly believed what he believed, and he firmly practiced what he believed to be the truth. There was one other point I wanted to make that related to Sid's comment. Well, it's about this Jewishness of things, and I'll have to wait until the Q&A for that. Because, again, the fact is, when you look at Paul, Paul was a Jew. Paul saw that Christianity was the completion. It was the climax. He saw that that's what it was all about. He didn't see this clear cut between Judaism and Christianity. He saw Christianity as being the fulfillment of it, that this is what he had been looking for, and this is what he wants Israel to look for. So, that's where I'll go ahead and end at that point. And if there's other things within this outline that you have questions about, I'll be happy to address them. If nobody has any questions, I'll just finish this outline, particularly the theological stuff. So anyway.